From Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Joyce Vance.
Hi, Joyce.
Hey, Preet. How are you doing?
I wonder what we're going to talk about today.
I cannot imagine.
So we don't have an indictment yet. We're recording this on Tuesday morning, March 28th. But before we get to that, we should note that once again, and I can't count how many times we've had to do this during the pendency of the show, another tragic mass shooting, this time in Nashville, 6 dead plus the shooter, including 3 9-year-old children. I know you've been doing or had to do in the past couple of days breaking coverage. How do you even do that?
You know, it's really hard. I'm a little bit fortunate in that when I do that, it's often with my former ATF special agent in charge, Jim Cavanaugh, who had the ATF region that includes Nashville and Alabama. And we've worked a lot of tough cases, arsons, bombings, shootings together for over a decade. And I find his presence to be sort of comforting in the face of that kind of tragedy. But, you know, I saw something that our former boss, Eric Holder, posted on Twitter that I thought was really great. It was just a graphic, and it had the words thoughts and prayers, and they were both crossed out. And inside of those two words in big, bold letters, it said action. And for me, I think that's what's going to get us through this tragedy is this notion that we have to take action no matter where we are. It's just not enough to not take action anymore.
Yeah. We'll come back to that. I'm sure we'll be talking about gun violence at some length again soon, unfortunately. So the Trump indictment that did not come. You and I and Ellie and Barb had our little roundtable last week at which I asked the question, do we still think it's coming? And I, you know, sort of said 94.3%, I think, or did I say 93.4%? I can't remember. So now it's been a week since Trump himself falsely said he was going to be arrested last Tuesday. Do you think that the odds of an indictment have gone down at all, or they're just crossing T's, dotting I's? What do you think is happening, and will we still see an indictment with respect to the hush money payments?
When we learned yesterday that the mysterious witness that everyone has been talking about was David Pecker from the National Enquirer, that reinforced my confidence that we'll see an indictment in this case. Because, look, let's be clear, Pecker certainly is a witness who could say things that would help the former president, but he has already cooperated in the federal case. His testimony is known. The fact that the DA put him on to respond to Bob Costello suggests to me that he was testifying to say whatever Michael Cohen might have said to Bob Costello at the time, these are the conversations that Michael Cohen, Donald Trump, and I had. And that seems to me to be linchpin evidence for any prosecutor.
At the risk of getting overly philosophical, I've thought a bunch more this week. I spent an hour talking about the potential indictment with my students at NYU yesterday. So I think that there's a lot to be learned from here, a lot of teaching to be done through the lens of this case, how prosecutors make decisions, how they exercise discretion, and the circumstances in which you do or do not proceed, even if you have enough evidence to charge a crime. Because it's the case that on every occasion where there's evidence of a crime, do you charge it? And I was noting in my notepad when I was teaching my class yesterday that exactly a year ago, we were discussing another potential criminal case in which charges were not brought, depending on how you look at it, much less serious. But everyone was talking about it. It was the day after the Oscars. And all that anybody could talk about was that Will Smith had slapped Chris Rock on stage live before like a billion people. That is as open and shut an assault case as you can bring. And yet the DA did not bring an assault charge. And for the most part, I and most people I spoke to didn't think it was warranted, even though there was enough evidence to bring the charge, because sometimes you don't do it. And here, and I'm just really curious to get your view since it's been a few days since we've spoken. You know, I've got friends who I respect and intelligent people who I talk to who want to see Trump held accountable for various things, including January 6th. And they're no allies of Trump. And they're not so pleased with the idea of this prosecution because they think it's not serious enough. And I've been thinking about what they've been saying. I'm not sure I agree. I think people are underestimating the seriousness of the conduct, and we'll talk about why that is. But have you thought further about that, about the propriety of bringing this case even if there's enough evidence?
You know, I have. I think that that's really important. I would assume that that's what the Manhattan DA's office is focused on in large part. And part of the issue that we have discussing this is that in a sense, we're blind because we don't know exactly what their evidence is. But if their evidence suggests, as many people think it will, that what Trump did in regards to the Stormy Daniels payment was to enter into a conspiracy designed to sort of surreptitiously funnel payment to her on the eve of the election with the intent to impact the outcome of that election, I don't have any problem with saying that that's a serious crime. And we know from other cases that this is a charge, assuming that the Manhattan DA goes with the business records charge, that is prosecuted. It's not like they dug through the books to find some obscure crime to charge Trump with. So, you know, you isolate this question. We're assuming just for the sake of argument that they have sufficient evidence. And then the question is this within, you know, the heartland of cases that the office would charge if the defendant wasn't named Donald Trump? And if the answer to that question is yes, then I don't really think that this is like Will Smith or and any of the other celebrity cases that we've talked about where cases are being charged because someone is a celebrity. This is, if those are the facts, a case that should be charged.
But people are also making the argument, and I'm not saying I agree with this, but I think it's worth fleshing out and being honest and candid and fair and thorough about the analysis here because it's such a momentous thing. People are saying a little bit, there's an appearance potentially that Donald Trump is being prosecuted here because he's the former president. And this case could have been brought by the Southern District of New York, my former office, and we talked about that a little bit last week. And they chose not to do it, and a lot of time has gone by, and maybe there's new evidence that has come to light in the DA's investigation. But if it turns out that no new evidence came to light, and the record is the same as it's been for 5 years, is there some risk that it looks a little bit more selective and targeted because it's Donald Trump than otherwise?
I think it's very messy. As we discussed with Barb and Ellie, it's pretty clear why the case wasn't prosecuted while Trump was still president. For one thing, there was an OLC memo that said you couldn't indict a sitting president, and Bill Barr was tamping down on investigation. And I guess the question is, did that tamp down on investigation make it impossible for Merrick Garland to bring the charges, or did he have some other reason? Regardless of how that plays out, you know, Alvin Bragg is a duly elected district attorney in Manhattan. He's got different statutes than DOJ had. He gets to make his own decisions. That's what the people in Manhattan elected him to do. The point you're making, I think, is the subtle one is, will this cause a backlash, right? Whether that's this sort of backlash that one fears to see after the Waco rally over the weekend, or will smart thinking people who are used to looking at prosecutorial decisions sort of throw their hands up in the air and say, you know, this really wouldn't be charged if it wasn't Trump. Bragg is going to, I think, have to sell his case, no matter how meritorious it is. And that's a bad position for a prosecutor to be in, but he's going to have to sell it publicly.
Yeah. And I think we should take a shot at doing that in a moment after we first, you know, note what criticisms are possible. But here's the other question. I took a poll of my class, 17 super smart students at NYU Law School. All 17 of them and I agreed that if the only evidence that Alvin Bragg has is sufficient to charge Trump with a falsification of business records charge, which is just a misdemeanor, a year or less in prison, even if there was proof beyond a reasonable doubt to charge the misdemeanor, and even if it's true, as we stipulate, that many people have been charged with a misdemeanor in New York if they're ordinary citizens, we all were unanimous that Bragg should not charge Trump if all he had was a misdemeanor. And I tried to figure out like why that is, and there's no, you know, super principled answer other than, you know, it seems kind of small and petty to go through all the trouble of charging a former president with a misdemeanor and the resources that would have to be expended and the backlash and all the criticism that would arise, you know, it's some combination of all of those things. So, well, that's interesting. On the other end of the spectrum, in terms of seriousness, if Donald Trump could be charged with, and there was sufficient evidence to prove that he shot someone on Fifth Avenue, his famous mention, everyone was unanimous that he obviously should be charged. But we've already conceded that there's a certain kind of charge that's not serious enough to bring when you're talking about the former president, and that's the misdemeanor. So where on the spectrum between misdemeanor and homicide do you find that conduct is serious enough to charge? And why is it a 4-year felony, you know, a class E felony? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Aren't you glad you're not Alvin Bragg right now?
It's tough. I mean, just to pause for a second, people should understand. I know there's some people who are like, this is ridiculous, don't charge him. And some people are, well, this is ridiculous, you should charge him. It's a no-brainer. None of this is not a no-brainer. This is a complicated and difficult one before we even get to the legal issues.
Right. And I think it's an issue where reasonable people can disagree. And that's why it's so important to have these kind of public conversations, because there is some species of crime here where, you know, I mean, there's this groupthink that prosecutors sometimes have. We used to have this in my old office where we would sort of acknowledge that we had to make a decision where we were going to have to do the right thing. And we all understood what that meant, but it can be difficult to articulate. So my right thing here centers on the facts. And maybe I'm just repeating what I said before, but Michael Cohen has already gone to prison for these circumstances.
That's the best answer that you've just given.
Right. For reasons we don't fully understand, Trump hasn't. If the evidence is that Trump did this totally or in part in an effort to salvage an electoral victory, then I think that that's the justification that Bragg would need to say that it's important enough to prosecute.
Yeah, look, Joe Tacopina, one of Trump's lawyers and others who are supporting Trump, keep saying a thing that drives me up a wall, right? There are criticisms to make. They're being made on the part of people who are not Trump supporters, as we mentioned already. But when I hear Tacopina and others say, the only person in the world who would ever be charged with something like this is Donald Trump. It's only because it's Donald Trump. No one else would ever be in the crosshairs like this. I'm like, no, there's a guy who literally went to prison, not for a crime like this, but this exact crime, and who was a less culpable member of the scheme. So a guy who already went to prison, federal prison, for this crime, in a situation like that, you cannot go on television or anywhere and say blithely, only Donald Trump would have been prosecuted for something like this, because there's already a person who did. And whether you like that or not, the fairness argument is, well, why shouldn't the more culpable person, why shouldn't the person who was directing the conduct, if you believe Michael Cohen's allocution at his plea, why shouldn't that person be held accountable too? I think that's the best answer.
I think it is too, and I would make it maybe even a little bit more forcefully by saying, this isn't a case where you've got the less culpable person convicted and you're equivocal about the evidence, about the principal, the most culpable person. This is, if it's as we expect it to be, a case where that evidence is clear. And why would you not charge the principal if the evidence is clear?
Well, in real life, that happens all the time, because it's one thing to have a guilty plea from the underling. It's another thing to prove beyond a reasonable doubt at trial a crime against the principal. It happens all the time. It happens in mob cases. It happens in white-collar cases because there's insufficient evidence. And as far as SDNY goes, you know, my guess is that part of the reason they didn't bring the case is they have this, you know, strong policy of only cooperating a witness who has, you know, pled to everything and has revealed everything and has disclosed everything. And as the papers filed in court have said on the part of SDNY, Michael Cohen was not fully forthcoming. And as a policy matter, that's a person you can't have as your witness. And if you can't have him as your witness, very difficult to try and convict Donald Trump. And also Donald Trump has other defenses as well.
And of course, that doesn't impact Bragg because he doesn't have that same sort of a policy. I mean, the interesting question is, and you alluded to this earlier, does Bragg have better evidence? Has the passage of time yielded cooperators or better documentary evidence? We're going to have to wait, right?
Usually not.
Well, I don't know. Can I just put this marker down? And I don't like to speculate about great evidence that people could get against Trump, because my experience over the last 7 or 8 years is that that never pans out. But, you know, supposedly David Pecker, the guy at the National Enquirer, had this special file in his safe that documented some of the stuff that they had done. Maybe that file is surfaced. Maybe, you know, witnesses who previously wouldn't cooperate have decided to cooperate and can be substantiated. We won't know until we learn more about the case. But that would certainly be a bright line justification for going ahead.
So just so we're clear, I want you on the record also. If the only evidence you had, and you're Alvin Bragg, was sufficient to charge a misdemeanor, you would bring that or you would not bring
that? No, I wouldn't go on the misdemeanor here.
Yeah. I just think it's useful to have that as a marker, because that does tell you that in some ways, the identity of the defendant affects the way in which you think about the charge, when we like to say all the time, no one's above the law. There are sometimes other considerations as well. And I've not talked to any reasonable person who thinks that a misdemeanor should be brought against Donald Trump. And in explaining that, it's not very satisfying to explain it.
Let's just spool it out a little bit, because there are these prudential democracy concerns, right? I mean, we do not want to become a banana republic where politicians are routinely prosecuted by their successors from other parties for purely political reasons. And even if there is technically a case, to avoid even the appearance of that sort of politicization of prosecution, I think we have to concede that the rank misdemeanor with no indication of a motive to manipulate the election just wouldn't be enough because of those prudential concerns.
Yeah. So let's talk about the strength of the case, having talked about the relative seriousness of the case. So just to remind everyone, based on what we understand the case to be about, two things have to be proven to make out the felony, right? First, that business records were falsified. And then second, that the falsification of those business records was done in the furtherance of some other crime or to conceal some other crime, right? So the first step is the falsification of business records. And the evidence, as we understand it, is that this hush money payment was made to Stormy Daniels. And on the books and records of the Trump Organization, it was claimed that it was a legal retainer, legal fees to Michael Cohen, because Michael Cohen was basically the pass-through for how the money went to Stormy Daniels. Like he fronted the money himself. He took out a home mortgage loan, which is interesting. And then he was reimbursed by the Trump Organization. Trump himself signed the checks for the amount that was paid to Stormy Daniels, plus a legal fee on top of that, right? And it was also more than was paid to Stormy Daniels, because Michael Cohen had to be made whole pre-tax, right? So the amount of money paid to Stormy Daniels had to be increased, because presumably this money that was being paid to Michael Cohen would owe taxes on. So to make him whole at the end of the day, he got the full reimbursement, plus trued up for tax purposes, plus a fee. And Joe Tacopina and others keep saying, well, there's no falsification of business records because it was a legal fee. Michael Cohen invoiced it and he's the one who arranged it and it was his advice and we did pay the lawyer. So no falsification of a business record. Is that right?
No, that's absolutely not right. Look, I mean, you know, I can make an invoice for a week at the spa and send it to a client and say, you know, here's my legal fees. And that doesn't change the basic nature of the funding, which was a donation to the Trump campaign.
Yeah, the way I thought about it is, if you buy a house for $1 million and your lawyer arranges for it and takes care of the paperwork and charges a fee and you pay your lawyer based on the invoice, $1.1 million, that's not, $1.1 million is not all legal fee and legal retainer. You bought a house and you can't disguise the purchase of a house, and that can have consequences for tax purposes or other purposes that you can imagine if investigations were to take place. And so the intent of the law, as far as I understand it, is for there to be integrity in business dealings. And the next question that arises, and it seems to be this is part of the defense, although it's not very beautifully articulated, is that so long as the record remains internal and it's a privately held company, I think this is the argument, you can say whatever you want on the books and records, because who cares? Because no misrepresentation was made to a third party with respect to that business record or to the government or to the IRS or anyone else. And I think that the defense is, if we've never had to pass along that, you know, allegedly false book or record to the government, then it's fine. Do you buy that?
You know, I think it's an argument that proves too much, because it's not like you're writing those records just for fun. You're writing those records to use them. You're going to use them when you pay taxes. You're going to use them when you do accounting, when you apply for loans, all sorts of valuation sorts of implications. So no, I don't buy that defense.
Yeah, I mean, it goes to the P&L of the company also, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is something an expense? Is something tax deductible? is something an asset that you've acquired? If it's an asset that you've acquired, does it go up or does it go down? And I know that's part of some other investigation that's been going on. So it seems to me, I mean, I'm trying to think if there are any other defenses on part one, the falsification of the business record. And by the way, this maybe plays in a little bit. The other defense, sort of, it's more optical defense, I think, than a real legal defense, is that Donald Trump was the victim of an extortion. And as a victim of an extortion, you know, what was he going to say? He said at one point, Tacopina, to someone interviewing him, I think it was to Chuck Todd, actually, you know, you're paying off your alleged mistress, former porn star. What are you going to say? As if that's a defense. That to me is more of a nullification argument, that the guy was, you know, between a rock and a hard place. What was he going to do? And as Chuck Todd said to the lawyer, yeah, how about the truth? Is the extortion argument viable in any way other than to get the jury to feel sorry for the defendant?
This notion of Donald Trump as a victim is a non-starter because there's too much evidence of how Trump handles even situations where he's at fault. Imagine a situation where someone's trying to extort him. He would just absolutely blow past it, right? There's no way that this guy who doesn't pay his legitimate bills would pay so much money and do it in such a surreptitious fashion if it was just a raw extortion.
So can you think of any other bases on which Alvin and the DA's office might fail to prove the falsification of a book or record?
You know, there is this language in the statute that talks about committing the conduct with an intent to defraud. I think that's really wrapped up in this argument that you've spooled out that Tacopina and others have made about, well, the records were just internal, so there can't be an intent to defraud. But it's worth pointing out that that's tied up with the language of the statute. And I think they'll try to float that both here and in connection with where you're going next with whatever crime is used to accelerate the misdemeanor into a felony.
Yeah, so then that's interesting. And people keep calling it a novel legal theory. Now, the phrase novel legal theory can refer to a lot of things. It can be used to refer to something that there's a lot of dispute about. And, you know, some jurisdictions say it's okay, and some jurisdictions say it's not okay. It can be something that's done and has been done, but has never been tested in the sense that a court has never directly ruled upon the propriety of the thing. Or it can be something that nobody's ever thought of before, it's not happened before, and that's why it's called novel. I think we're in category two. The DA's office, as I understand it, and people have documented these cases, has on many occasions brought a felony action with respect to falsification of books and records. And I think it's even done so in the case of, you tell me if I'm wrong, because you're a better scholar of these things than I am. It's even been done in connection with the furtherance of the second crime is a campaign finance crime. My understanding is, even though that's been done in the context of cases that have been resolved by plea, there is no case that has legitimized that practice. It's not been addressed specifically by the highest court in New York or any other court that I'm aware of. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that that's correct. And so that's to say that there are novel issues involved here. And of course, prosecutors don't love novel issues in important cases, which makes me wonder if they don't have something that's a little bit less legally novel in their hip pocket alongside this one.
Yeah, so if it's the case that it's novel and there are questions about the seriousness, I go back to the same earlier question because it's worth testing and retesting. Is it legitimate for people to question whether this is the right case?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And this is where I'll kick in with my appellate lawyer hat on, because I can think of a number of situations where prosecutors had a novel theory that they had worked out, that they wanted to charge in a righteous case. And the appellate lawyers, with a little bit of a cooler head, had to evaluate how much litigation risk there was, right? There's no point in putting your resources into a case only to lose it on appeal. And so we talked last week a little bit about percentages. What percentage certainty do you need to authorize on a case? Well, here's a place where I would really entertain that as an appellate lawyer, thinking about, you know, if there's an 80% chance I'm going to lose this one on appeal, well, I'm never going to authorize from the get-go. And you have to make that sort of assessment based on cases that have been decided, questions that are wide open for courts, and how you think the courts might rule on them based on other precedent.
I forgot what I said last week with respect to the question about how certain I would want to be that I could get a conviction on this charge against Donald Trump. I think I said, I don't know if I said 90%. And thinking about it for several more days, my percentage has gone up.
You want to be 99% sure?
98.6, you know, the normal body temperature of a human being.
I would want to be really sure too.
In the context that we're talking about, right? Given questions about the seriousness of the case, given the, you know, plausible arguments about the novelty of the theory, you want to be really damn sure. Because I think the consequence of going forward like this, unlike in some other cases, and losing a trial, they're just, it's just bad. It's bad for that office. It's bad for public trust. It's bad for people who think the rule of law is a fleeting concept in this country. And I, you know, maybe I'm overstating it, and next week I'll have a different view.
No, I don't think you are. I think you're right.
But I'm bothered by, you've got to be pretty damn sure in a case like this. You really do.
You know, the question is what you consider. And I know a lot of people worry about jury nullification, right? Getting some sort of a stealth juror who's going to torpedo the case. And I'll confess that that's one of those known unknowns that I tried to not worry about as a prosecutor. I tried to be sophisticated at selecting a jury. I tried to screen out people that I thought might do that. But ultimately, if I believed in the case, if I thought the evidence and the law was on my side, and not just in a 51% way, but as you say, in like a 98.6% way, then you go ahead and you try your case.
I mean, one piece of good evidence, I think, I wonder how strong you think this is. And again, Trump's lawyers try to spin it. Trump lied about knowing about the payment, right? And maybe it's the case you can just say, well, of course he's going to lie because it was about something that was personally embarrassing and he wanted to spare his family. But the other interpretation of the lie, as prosecutors often make this argument, is that it's consciousness of guilt. And he knew that there was something not just untoward, but perhaps unlawful about making that payment and characterizing it the way they characterized it. Which way does that cut, you think?
You know, I do think it's a consciousness of guilt argument. It was interesting that Trump repeated the lie again this weekend. A reporter named Von Hilliard was on the plane flight, I think maybe coming back from Waco with Trump, and asked that question, you know, when did you find out? And Trump sort of repeats that he didn't know and that he didn't know Stormy Daniels and had never had an affair with her. And I think that that really is something that prosecutors can use with a jury, because when a defendant is lying about something that they're claiming is innocuous, well, why are they telling the lie unless they do have consciousness of guilt?
Yeah. I mean, the other problem and worry one has is violence. We should spend some time talking about,
yeah,
you know, whatever you think about the case.
Wait, I have to ask you, what is wrong with New York? In every other jurisdiction that I'm familiar with, when you're talking about pretrial detention of a defendant, the court considers whether they're a flight risk and whether they're a danger to the community. And I am reliably told that in state court in New York, you only consider flight risk and not danger to the community. And so without weighing in on whether anything that Trump has done would ring the bell for detention, which I think is probably a higher bar than his conduct to date, I'm just stunned that that's not part of the calculation.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to talk about the bail laws in New York and how reform has been messed up, that's a whole other show and a half. So I'm not going to go there at this moment. But as you and I know, the federal system that we're familiar with allows for consideration of both things, and it makes sense and it works well. The one thing I'll say is, you know, John Oliver has a show every week on Sunday called Last Week Tonight. He picks a substantive topic every week and he talks about it. And often it's the case he talks about things and either in my current or prior life, you know, he's not a fan of prosecutors generally, but he talks about bail and bail reform. And he talks in part about how screwy it is in New York. And there was reason for reform because there were some things that were too onerous. And I think a lot of people legitimately say that it went too far in the other direction. And then I was very pleased to hear him say, you know, we actually do have a bail system that works really well in this country. It's the federal bail system.
Works great.
Right, in which you don't buy your freedom with money. You don't say to a person who's worth $10,000, $3 million bail. That's just stupid. It makes no sense. So anyway, John Oliver endorses the federal bail system. But let's point out just the complete irresponsibility and worse, disgusting nature of Donald Trump's attacks and suggestions of violence against Alvin Bragg. He had that thing that he posted on social media where he's wielding a baseball bat next to the face of Alvin Bragg. He's called Alvin Bragg a Soros-funded animal. And he's warned. And the question is, is it a warning? Is it a prediction? Or is it actually an incitement? He said, there will be death and destruction if I'm charged. Can't everyone criticize that and condemn that?
Stand back and stand by.
Right. I mean, the guy, he's literally being investigated for incitement on January 6th, and he's doing it again. What does that tell you?
You know, it tells me that he's really worried about getting indicted and he's sort of grasping at straws. But I think that there are a lot of answers to your question. There are good answers and bad answers. I mean, the reality is, as you say, can't we all condemn that? Aren't we a country that can take a step back and say that no one in public life should be drawing attacks on prosecutors, right? That's nuts. That's, can I say batshit crazy on the podcast?
Yes, you can.
It's just, you know my family story, right? My father-in-law is a federal judge who gets murdered by a mail bomber. We do not need people in public life who are encouraging violence against public officials, particularly if we want good people to continue to serve. I have heard our good friend Barb McQuaid say that she reconsidered running for public office in part because of the attacks that were made against elected Democratic officials in Michigan who were women. We do not need to lose good public servants like that. We should all condemn this kind of behavior.
We should. And we do. Our friend Mimi Rocha was on TV talking about it. And I think there was a letter signed by a lot of former prosecutors condemning it as well. And I think that's good. And I support that.
I think Mimi deserves a real shout out here because, you know, she makes the argument in non-political tones, right? She just says, no one should be trying to tell prosecutors what to do. We elect these people. Let's let them do their job without fear or favor, which is a lot harder to do when you're an elected district attorney than when you're an appointed U.S. attorney. And maybe what we need is for the country to rally around these principles of federalism, right? Freedom from congressional interference. But it's more than just that. It's that prosecutors shouldn't be pressured by people in their own sort of ecosphere. Prosecutors should just be left to do the job. And if you don't like the job that they're doing, the time to speak up is at the ballot box.
One more thing I was thinking about, going back to what we were discussing earlier, and that is that no crime was committed here. And the way that Tacopina and others try to explain away the fact that Michael Cohen pled guilty to exactly that crime, they love to say he's a liar, he's a perjurer, he's a criminal in all these respects, he's a scumbag, he's a lowlife, he's a traitor. But they say that he pled guilty to a non-crime. That in the one thing that implicates Donald Trump, he's a criminal in all the other respects, and the taxi medallion thing and tax avoidance is a tax cheat. But the one thing that shows that there's a predicate for charging Donald Trump, that wasn't a crime. And I don't remember, and maybe I'm wrong, but I don't remember people saying when Michael Cohen pled guilty in the Southern District of New York that he was being railroaded and that this was a miscarriage of justice. And I know the answer to the question as to why Trump didn't pardon Michael Cohen was he was on the outs and he felt betrayed. But I wonder if you think that he might be in a better position to argue about his own innocence, and maybe not. Maybe it's overly clever that I'm thinking about this. But if there was no crime there, and Donald Trump pardoned all sorts of other people who did commit crimes, how can you say now it was not a crime? Wouldn't it be easier to say that if he had pardoned Michael Cohen, at least for the aspect of the case that involved the hush money payment? Am I being silly?
Are you trying to say that the former president is not strategic and can't play three-dimensional chess?
But it's just a little weird that they're saying that one thing was not a crime. And if it wasn't a crime, well, why didn't you pardon the guy?
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me after the election when Trump maintained that there was fraud that resulted in him not getting elected, but all of those Republican senators who got elected on the, you know, that was kosher. I mean, it just is demonstration of what we know, right? That this is not somebody who's honest. It's not even somebody who's strategic. It's just someone who's opportunistic.
One final thing before we go and return to Indictment Watch. We talked last week about this letter from three Republican House chairmen to Alvin Bragg. I think since the time we spoke, Alvin Bragg and his chief counsel, his general counsel, have responded, I thought, pretty strongly and legitimately to say you really can't interfere in ongoing local investigation. Obviously, the Justice Department has told Congress you can't get real-time inside confidential information about an ongoing federal investigation. That goes double for a local investigation. I wonder sometimes if these Republicans have forgotten the concept that they seem to love so much, federalism. And Bragg and his counsel have said that they will provide some information about the use of federal funds. And now the chairman have written another letter. It's a letter war back and forth. They have not issued a subpoena yet. What do you make of all that?
Yeah, I think this last letter from Congress gives Bragg a March 31st deadline. So presumably they'll issue a subpoena and duke it out in court if they don't get a positive response from him. But this letter that Bragg submitted, I think, is very well done. They say up front, if you want to talk about federal funding, let us know what you want. Let's sit down and talk about it. We'll give you what you need. We'll even write you a list. But they make the federalism argument, which is, as you point out, is an argument that I'm used to hearing Republicans make, that the federal government should not interfere in state and local priorities. It's a tough argument to respond to, and I wonder if, you know, Republicans are thinking about how this might play out if they want to intrude in what local DAs are doing. What would that look like if it became open season in Congress to go after local district attorneys? That violates federalism principles. It's really abhorrent to the rule of law. It's not the way we want the country to run. Hopefully, they won't file a lawsuit after a subpoena. But if they do, I think it'll be a lengthy litigation progress all the way up to the Supreme Court. And I would hope that the court would stand by the rights of prosecutors in states and counties to remain free from inappropriate congressional interference. There might be some scope of appropriate congressional inquiry. It's just that it doesn't exist here, whereas Bragg has said this letter is written, you know, like moments after Trump says, I'm going to be arrested on Tuesday.
Do you think Fani Willis of Fulton County, Georgia, gets a similar letter? And why hasn't she so far?
They don't need to, because the Georgia legislature is on track to pass this law. It cleared the Georgia House yesterday that will permit the legislature in Georgia to engage in, they're calling it oversight, but really it's just, I'm not going to swear twice in one episode, just smacking around a prosecutor who they don't like what they're doing. And it's clearly directed at Black prosecutors in major areas in Georgia, like Fulton County. And so Georgia's cleaning up its own problem, unlike your New York legislature, would be the Republicans' point of view. But maybe Fani gets a letter too.
Do you think when we convene next Tuesday that there will be an indictment on the books against Donald Trump?
Oh, my crystal ball is cloudy on that one. If everything is on track, there could be an indictment tomorrow. Of course, it's also possible, you know, people have debated, will Alvin Bragg get an indictment and seal it so he can set stuff up? It's possible that there could be an indictment that we don't know about. It's hard to think that wouldn't start to leak out. But I really don't know. What do you think?
I think it's likely, but I don't know either. My crystal ball has the same weather forecast as yours.
But, you know, my crystal ball says, don't rule out Jack Smith, who's been sort of quiet and in the background, but could be getting close too, although he now has a few more witnesses to hear from in the grand jury.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost difficult to fit everything into one show. There are four areas of criminal legal jeopardy for Trump. We mostly talked about one. We talked a little bit about the second in Fulton County, and then there's two with the Justice Department, both the Mar-a-Lago documents and January 6th. I think the January 6th one, a decision on that, whether to go forward with an indictment or not, is the one that's farthest off. But we will follow. We will be on indictment watch for you. I'm really curious, by the way, Joyce, to hear from our listeners on this question of the Manhattan DA's office's case Do you think it's appropriate or not? Do you think it's serious enough or not? I'm just curious to hear what our listeners think. So send us your questions, send us your thoughts about that and anything else to letters@cafe.com.
We'll look forward to answering them.
That's it for this week. Cafe Insider is presented by Cafe Studios and the Vox Media Podcast Network. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Joyce Vance. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The editorial producer is Jake Kaplan. The audio producer is Nat Wiener. And the Cafe team is David Tatasciore, Matthew Billy, Adam Waller, David Kurlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Namita Shah, Claudia Hernandez, and Sean Walsh. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.